Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. David Matthews as my special expert guest. Dr. David Matthews is a graduate of Brown University and the College of Medicine at the University of Cincinnati. He did his residency training at the Hospital of Pennsylvania in general surgery and plastic surgery, and received his fellowships in microsurgery and craniofacial surgery. Dr. Matthews' medical practice in Charlotte, North Carolina, is approximately 80 to 90% reconstructive, with about 60% dedicated to children with facial birth defects. His interest in what causes birth defects in children led him to Dr. Michael Colgan and the field of functional medicine. Dr. Matthews is certified as a trainer in the Colgan Power Program and Russian kettlebells. He has also been selected for best doctors in region and nationally for the past 10 years. Good morning, David, and thank you so much for taking the time to participate as my special guest on this edition of SNU.
Well, good morning, Corey, and thank you for the honor.
Dave, everyone wants to know about what you're doing in your medical practice, I'm sure. So tell us why you got into the field of medicine and why you have developed such an interest in reconstructive surgery.
Well, it's sort of like what you do, Corey. It's a challenge. It's a different, rather you're looking at someone's health and fitness, and I'm looking at a problem which I'm trying to solve for them. And that's how I got into medicine, through that same venue. I wanted to have some means of trying to help people because I feel that's what we need to try and do someplace in this world. And I found medicine was a good way of doing it. When I started off in orthopedic surgery. I was convinced I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. But as I grew older, and I realized that the kids with congenital problems were the hardest possible things to correct and also the most rewarding. And that was the real reason why I started the reconstructive practice, and that's what I've been doing for the last 25 years.
So maybe give us some details. A common situation, a child comes in and that you get involved with when you first see a patient and what leads to the surgery. What kind of situations are coming at you on a weekly or monthly basis?
A lot of it is, for years, was trauma. Car accidents, automobile accidents, where the face is totally broken. And putting that back together, trying to get them back into their pre-injury appearance, is a challenge. But harder are the children, and harder on the people's hearts that they have a child that you come in to see in the hospital, just as their child's been born, and they have a cleft of the face, or a hair lip, or cleft lip, or some other significant deforming feature of the face. And they really can't even hear you until you say the words, "We can fix this, this will be okay." And then they can start understanding. And I guess that's why I stayed with kids and really put my heart into that.
You know, that's nice to hear, because I just read an article by Patch Adams, and he said that in medicine, doctors are taught not to have any direct, intimate relationships that involve emotion with their patients, but he says that's what kills them. That's what causes disease in their own minds and in their own bodies. He's talking about the doctors, not the patients. So do you find that you do get involved, like on a personal level, with your patients? And if so, do you find that that's what's so rewarding?
I found it is rewarding. I get involved with the life, because with the children, you have to follow them for their whole growth period, which for males is up to 18 or 20 years. So I get their graduation pictures. I get their high school prom pictures sent to the office. So you just follow them along, maybe a little bit at distance, but you know them very well, and you watch them grow up. And so you're sort of like a second cousin to the family. You know the family, you know them very well, and you're helping from the outside. And that itself is good. It's nice. One of the patients I had was valedictorian here in one of the high schools, and he had a bilateral cleft. And he spent his graduation speech talking about his experience. And he sent me a copy of his valedictorian speech, which was very interesting.
That must have been really gratifying. Now, does your personal interest in nutrition, and I have some idea what that is because of our relationship and our connection in nutrition and fitness, does that provide your patients with any special advantages?
I think it does, because I'm a sounding board for them to bounce off the current fads that come around seemingly on a monthly basis, that this is going to be the new cure-all, that this bill this time is going to fix it. And I have to moderate that in that it's total care, and that if they had to choose one thing, that exercise is probably the most important factor outside of fresh air, fresh oxygen, and some water. That exercise is probably the next most important thing to do, and diet comes next, then supplements are after that. So you have to put that in perspective for them. The other thing that helps is many people come in post-injury and from automobile accidents, and a lot of times they don't get adequate rehabilitation. And so you can help them focus on the rehab and ways of stretching, or ways to improve their range of motion and strength, so they don't get trapped into a compromised situation.
How many children are born in the U.S. each year that require the type of medical expertise that you provide, approximately?
It's hard to give you an exact number to the total numbers, but about 1 in 800 births have a deformity of the face, which is relatively common. Cleft lip and palate is the most common of those. And then some of the rarer forms that have clefts are involved, the cranial skeleton, are 1 in 200,000.
1 in 200,000. Now, tell us about the paper you've been working on titled Maternal Micronutrient Status and Risk of Oral Fissure Clefts. I know I had a chance to read that paper. There's some really neat stuff in there that people need to know. What are some of the highlights of that paper?
Well, this really stemmed from my interest in nutrition, looking at the micronutrient statuses in trying to look at what might prevent a cleft. And there's a lot of stuff out in the literature, and what we did in this paper is go back and review the literature of everything out there relating to micronutrient status and clefting. And it's been well known that folic acid is significant for birth defects, especially on spinal cord and neural tube defects. But we found that there's a lot of evidence out showing that B vitamins, zinc, folic acid, are all equally important in helping prevent defects. And if there's a deficiency in those, you increase the risk of facial clefting. And that's what we've been looking at, and we can make some recommendations on that, that people get healthy before they plan to conceive, and prenatal vitamins should be taken prior to conception rather than after the fact.
Do you prescribe a lot of vitamin supplements or recommend specific types of supplements on a regular basis?
Where I get involved is usually after the fact. It's hard to change the medical system right now, in that the family doc supervising the pregnancy or the obstetrician supervising the pregnancy put people on the traditional prenatal vitamins, but there's no screening done ahead of time to sign that with people, the population, are increased risk. There's a subset of the population that's deficient in some of the enzymes that metabolize folic acid, and that represents, 15 to 20% of the population, and they could be screened easily and give an extra folic acid, because there's no downside to that, particularly if they're getting B12. And that's not being done. And we're trying to start a pilot study here looking at using a intracellular analysis on women that have on ultrasound birth defects when they have their ultrasound in their first or second trimester. And the micronutrient status can be determined for about 5 months prior to that. And so we have some idea where they were at the time of conception, and see if we can get some better correlation on where this is. But common sense would show that prevention is much better than trying to treat this afterwards.
So we have really got to get to the origin of cause, more or less, and get people aware about how important it is to prevent these clefts that you are faced to deal with after the fact.
Well, it would be a huge cost to savings for society and emotionally for the families and their children, that stuff they have to go through.
What is the prognosis for a child that's brought in? Like, can you really make a large, major difference in their appearance? And are people are happy, or do they move through a whole series of different surgeries so that eventually, over time, it gets to the point where they're happy with the outcome or the appearance?
Well, Corey, you know me. I want to have them normal. And I'll work to try to get them as normal as possible. And one of the best compliments I ever had was I had a teenager coming in. She was on the bus next to one of her boyfriends. And she said she was coming for surgery. He said she had a cleft lip and palate. And he said, "I don't see anything wrong with you." And that's the way you want it to be. So you make them as normal as possible. They'll have a scar, but you can blend the scar into the natural lines as much as possible. They try to make the shape, the speech, and everything else normal. And that can be done pretty well now.
So for those who don't know, maybe you could tell us exactly what a cleft palate is and how it forms inside the fetus. And we know that we can prevent it with the B12, folic acid, the nutrients, that they influence enzymes. But when it doesn't prevent that and it evolves into that, what we see, what's actually happened in the lip and in the facial area?
Well, a cleft palate is in the roof of your mouth, and it's really a communication between the mouth and the nose that extends from the little thing that hangs down the back, what we call the uvula, that gets swollen when you have a sore throat, all the way up through where the teeth come through, we call the alveolus, and through the lip itself. And this communication can go into the nose through the entire length. And so, as a child, it makes it much harder to have a suck. They cannot have normal speech, because all the sounds are coming through both the nose and the mouth at the same time. So we have what we call hypernasal speech. And they have the bony deficiency where they're missing a tooth as well. One tooth, maybe two teeth, depending. Sometimes not any teeth, but generally a tooth is missing permanently. The surgery involves many steps to fix this. I personally like to align the skeletal segments first and then repair the bony parts, and then the palate, and then the lip. And there's some new developments in this. We're trying to use some bone morphogenic protein to help build bone at early age and prevent some growth defects and growth inhibition that'll happen along the cleft. And it's too soon to see how this is going to work yet, but it seems early on that it's going to be fairly successful in terms of good bone formation. And it saves them some bone grafting later on. The other issue is speech that has to be normal. And there's no exception except for normal speech. Our society stigmatizes anybody that has abnormal speech too much. So we have to make that normal. That's what the defect is. And with it can come along some pituitary problems or other associated cardiac or general ureter problems in 5 to 10% of children.
So it's a very complex area, a very important area. Like you say, we have a stigmatism about how people speak, and I guess kids can go through a real battle, a real tough time with other kids making fun of them, and can suffer emotionally through most of their life, even as adults.
They sure can. It's interesting, I'm seeing more and more adults in my practice now coming in at their 40s and 50s wanting to get repaired. They said they've had this all their life, and they're the product of what was able to be done 30 years ago, and we're better now. So they're coming in to get things done, which shows that we're getting better and shows that they still care about what they look like, and it's still, as you said, it's been a social stigma to them, and they want to get it fixed even late in life.
Now let's get into your training and certification experience with Dr. Colgan. Let's talk about the Colgan Power Camps. How did you come across Michael? And because we know that you're now teaching with the camp and that you're certified through his program, the Colgan Power Program Camp. Maybe you could talk about that and what your experience has been and how that has helped you in your own personal life, just with your own health and wellness.
I ran into his book, The New Power Program, and I said, this is the first time someone wrote a book that made sense from a physiological point of view. So he was supposed to give a seminar in Los Angeles. This is 7 or 8 years ago. And he got canceled. And so he got canceled twice. So I said, well, maybe I have to go to the source. So maybe I have to go to Canada. And that's how I ended up going up there. And Michael and I hit it off. We think alike. And he was instrumental for me understanding the science of exercise, because I'd never been exposed through all my education. I'd never been exposed to any of the real training principles that exist. And so it was eye-opening for me. And then, although I had done surgical nutrition, trying micronutrient, IV nutrition in surgical patients for years, I never really looked at all the cofactors and all the vitamins and how they worked on the electron transport chain, the Krebs cycle. And he got me thinking about this, and this all made me start thinking about the children and the birth defects. And I knew they were associated with folic acid. And so this all came together that way. But it's been an experience for me to help up there. It keeps me on my toes. It helps me with my personal exercise programs and gives me another source of stimulation.
Now, I know that there's three levels of certification through the POWER program. Perhaps you could comment on those. For those of our listeners who have never heard of the program or are not familiar with it, maybe you could enlighten them as to what they might expect by going to these camps and what the process is to reach the higher level of certification.
The program itself involves, it's not just a trainer, it's really doing a biomechanical assessment of a client to see their strength, the muscle strength, their flexibility, their posture, and designing a program that's going to help achieve the normal posture and to correct their deficiencies and imbalances in strength training that they've done before or in their lifestyle, whichever has been most detrimental to them. And incorporate that with some elements of nutrition, but a lot of science in terms of how to set up a program to emphasize the right groups. And it's broken down into three levels. First level is more the general principles, and the second level involves a deeper insight and more hands-on training and a oral exam with a mock client like myself or another trainer that has to be assessed and put through a whole program. So you really have to be on your toes. And also involves part one of your sports nutrition course, which you now changed into modules. And part three is a step further along with the requirement of the second part of your sports nutrition course. But there's a lot of science behind all this. The power camps themselves sort of put it all together in terms of trying to apply plyometrics and different types of stretching modalities to get the most out of the people that come to the camps.
What was your experience when you first came with your own personal health? Did you find a certain area, be it flexibility, strength, aerobic capacity, nutrition, certain concepts of food? What really stood out in your mind that really sent you home thinking?
The biggest thing, I think, was, although it was in medicine, I did not think that postural defects could be corrected as easily as they could be. And number two, I didn't think of the body being as a functional, constant replacing mass of cells. So that we replace our cells basically every year. We're a whole new person. Most of our bones, some of our muscle, or all our red cells, our skin, our white blood cells, all replaced, you know, every so often. And nutrient interactions affect the DNA in these turnovers. And if you're not eating right, you affect at a less optimal cell growth. And you set up your own internal demise, so to speak.
Very well put. Yeah, and I really finally got what Michael was saying. You know, it took me a while to get it. He said that two men are standing beside each other. One's 80 and one's 14, and they're both the same age. And I didn't quite get that until that cellular mass that you spoke of, you know, like we turn ourselves inside out. We've got a whole new cluster of cells, you know, based on the replication driven by genes that are renewed. So in 1 year, that 14-year-old and that 80-year-old man both have regenerated and produced a whole new set of cells. So they're both 1 year old. I think that's kind of cool.
It is very cool. But it just shows you how much nutrients are important. And that's the thing that's been left out of the American medical system and a lot of the Canadian medicine system the same way. The pharmaceutical companies have really pushed into medical education significantly with increasing complications, because they have a lot more complications in pharmaceutical drugs rather than in natural medicines.
What is the future of functional medicine as it permeates and moves into, you know, standard conventional medicine? Can we expect the changes that those of us that have seen that light, so to speak, that are enlightened as to what you're speaking about, can we expect to see the changes that we all want in the future? And if so, how long do you think that might take?
Oh, I'm not sure how long it would take. It takes a mindset difference to change from a conventional thinking to a more open and more flexible thinking system, and trying to use the least invasive way of doing it. But it involves more than the physician or the health practitioner making a change. It involves a change in the patient or client, because they have to make a lifestyle change to institute this. And this is the hardest thing I see for people, is to be willing to make a lifestyle change to institute a change in their exercise program, going from no exercise to some, the change, it cuts some of the refined carbohydrates out of their diet, so their blood pressure will be more easy to control. But if we don't do it, we're going to bankrupt our medical system, because we're not going to be able to take care of all the diabetics that are happening in the United States, because it's just getting rampant.
I read a stat yesterday about the increasing numbers of senior citizens. The prediction is that by 2050, 21% of the U.S. population will be 65 and over. And as you know, we can expect all kinds of people with health problems with this current epidemic of obesity. So you're right, maybe the economics itself, not the cause, not the philosophy, but just pure economics might be what it takes to see that change. But getting now into exercise, because you speak so highly of it, and I know that you're very committed, and it's wonderful to see a man like yourself who stands on top of the hill and says, you know, get out and move your butt, but do it in a very specific way. So what principles, as they relate to exercise, do you think are important for the average man? Because it's one thing for a guy to come in and see a doctor, and the doctor says, okay, go exercise, and you send him away, and he really has no specificity of what that means. How do you label exercise, and what do you think that means?
Well, I think it has to be individualized to the person. I think people need to understand that that high-intensity exercise is going to be the best if they want to try to gain lean body mass and reverse sarcopenia. And that's going to have to be done with some kind of resistance training or high-intensity interval training and running. But it has to be high-intensity to do that. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions. One, a lot of people are afraid to go to a gym because they've never been taught how to exercise. They're not willing to team up with somebody or to use a buddy system or find a friend. It doesn't have to be done with a trainer, but it has to be initiated by a trainer, and they have to be trained by a trainer to learn how to exercise properly so they don't get hurt. And someone has to modify their training so it fits their needs. And that's where I think the power program comes in, and my medical background comes in terms of trying to make an exercise prescription for people. And I think that's what has to be done, because we're not taught in school how to exercise or the science of exercise. None of us have, unless we've gotten extra training, have anything more than an elementary school education. We've never gone to high school for exercise science.
That's a very good point, and one of the points that I continuously make, too. I figure in 12 years of school, grade 1 through 12, we could pump out high school graduates that could create an exercise routine based on biomechanics and functional medicine, and also understand the basic science-driven principles of nutrition. But, of course, we understand why those limitations are there, and those need to change and reform. Because I think getting at the young kids, the elementary age, is really the key to make the massive change in the network of thinking out there, as you so wisely bring our attention to. Now, my curiosity here, certification in Russian kettlebells. What is a kettlebell? You know, I remember kettlebells from looking at magazine ads in old magazines from ages ago when I was just a kid. You never really see them talked about or portrayed anywhere in the gyms, but why the interest in kettlebells, the certification, and what is it about them that attracts you to them?
When I saw them, I thought of how people age and how they lose the power in their buttocks and their hamstrings and their quadriceps, and because they're working in the bent over position sitting, and that's the loss of, as you know, trying to train someone to get gluteal function back again is hard. And the Russian kettlebells do this. They force you to keep your shoulders back. And basically, you have this ball, you swing it between your legs, so you get into a modified squat, hinging at your waist with your shins vertical, and you explode upward. And so it's a dynamic, aerobic, and weight exercise that's very efficient. So you get your heart rate up in a hurry, and it's hard to keep going for more than about 5 minutes, because it's like running a mile in 5 minutes. You're moving, but you're doing with 70 pounds or 100 pounds. And you can do a lot of other exercise with it, and it's very safe. But that's how I got interested, because I saw the dynamics of it and how it helped reverse a lot of the things I saw in people as they get older.
Now, I asked someone the other day what they thought a kettlebell was, just as a test question, and the first thing that came to their mind was an old-fashioned dumbbell, two round balls with an iron rod in the middle, but that's not what a Russian kettlebell looks like, is it?
No, it's a ball with a handle on it. It's a cast iron ball with a handle that you can use with two hands or one hand.
It's kind of like a large shot put, isn't it?
Correct, with a handle on it. And they come in different weights, and you can swing them up over your head, and that actually increases shoulder mobility because the weight's on the back side of your wrist as you're coming up overhead. So you have to move your chest forward, which increases your shoulder mobility as you do it. So it works. Increases stability in your shoulder. You have to learn how to lock your shoulder in. You have to learn tension when you exercise so you can stay focused. There's a lot of variations of this. There's a windmill, which you know is an old exercise, where you put the arm up over your head and you bend down to the side, bend forward so you touch the ground and pick up another weight. You see people back in the 1890s doing this with a barbell held over their head and bending down, touching the floor. But it's a very good, intense core exercise because you have to use everything in your body to maintain your position. It's done very slowly. And this works well with kettlebells. You can do it with other weights as well.
And of course, being a hammer thrower, I can really relate to a kettlebell because we actually do training with a modified form and a weight throw they have in track and field where we're throwing quite a heavy implement. We throw it a lot shorter distance than an actual hammer, but it's very similar. And I can see that the kettlebells would be excellent, like you say, for core training, but also for a lot of dynamic speed and power movement where I'm sure that there are entire manuals written on all the different exercise techniques that you can incorporate for kettlebell training.
There are. There are some of them that are available easily, more some tapes, but it's one of these things that you almost have to see and be supervised to catch the nuances of it, because it's hard to get it all from just reading a book or watching a videotape or a CD.
Well, that's extraordinary. That's very interesting. David, I got time for one more question, and I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Now, if a complete fitness assessment was mandatory for each patient to complete before passing a standard medical exam, going to the physician's office, we have a regular medical exam, but you had to have a complete physical assessment, what effect would this have nationally on the prevention of disease and illness?
Oh, this would be a huge effect if you had to maintain a certain fitness level. It would drop incidence of hypertension and drop the incidence of diabetes, I think, significantly, if you had to maintain a certain fitness level. There's no question that exercise for diabetics increases the glucose uptake in the muscle, and that's going to make it easier for them to control their insulin, keep their insulin level down to a normal level, and because the sugar would be uptaken by the muscle better. I think you'll see this, and I think it would apply to cardiovascular disease. I think it would apply to some of the autoimmune diseases, because a lot of those seem to be inflammatory in nature as well. So I think it would have a huge effect.
And certainly we could start using a decent form of body composition analysis instead of that darn BMI, because I'm just tired of me being prorated against that standard and told that I'm obese.
Well, so am I.
Too much lean mass.
28, and you know, you probably run a little bit higher than that.
31. Oh my goodness! Let's focus on the quality of that mass, huh? Not just the amount of it. Well, what a great interview, and thanks so much, David. Let's bring people to your site. What is your website so people who have any interest in what you do or want to learn more about some of the reconstructive surgery that you do, what is your website, please?
Okay, the website is www.davidmatthewsmd.com, and it's a website that is going to be modified and improved because it's now just the initial hold the space as I changed my practice to a new setting as of 6 months, 8 months ago. The website has not been updated, but that's being worked on as we speak, actually.
Okay, that's great. I did have a chance to go through it the other day, and I'll look forward to seeing some of those updates. And again, everybody, that's www.davidmatthewsmd.com. Well, our time is gone, and thanks very much for a wonderful interview. And David, I would ask you now if you could just leave us with a final thought of inspiration. We always have our special guest leave us with a final word, just to drift in our minds, to meditate on, and something that might inspire us or motivate us for the rest of the day.
Well, this is from my daughter, Elise, who is the one on Colgan's website standing on one leg on a ball. And she says, ignore the buzz. Focus on what's right for your needs and stay with it.
Dr. David Matthews, whose specialty is in reconstructive surgery and is also certified through the Colgan Power Program and Russian kettlebells. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Corey.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Represent his lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU. Sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life. Live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see ya changing heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.